Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public, the Tuesday edition. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are pleased that you are with us. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we'll have excerpts from Our Living Lands, This Week in Water, Harvest Public Media, and also we'll hear from Dr. Tom Ezern. He talks about Samuel Western's new book, The Spirit of 1889. We begin Main Street today with an interview with Dr. Marion Nessel, who says if we want to make America healthy again, we need more than bans on food dyes. We need a total food system overhaul. She shares bold ideas to shift the focus from corporate profits to public health in this Conversations on Healthcare with co-hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner.
Dr. Nessel, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Glad to be here.
You're highly respected as a nutritionist, public health advocate, and author. You've called for a complete change in our food system. So let's start by asking you for your take on HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy, his Make America Healthy Again efforts, and his positions on what we eat.
Well, he says he wants to make America healthy again, and I'm totally for that. And he says he's particularly concerned about obesity and chronic disease. He wants to get ultra-processed foods out of schools. But mostly what he seems to be focused on is chemicals in the food supply. Now, I'm all for getting chemicals out of the food supply or questionable chemicals out of the food supply, like the color additives that are put into candy and cereals, but I don't think that goes nearly far enough. If he's going to be serious about making America healthy again from a food standpoint, he's going to have to do something about changing the food system to one that focuses on public health rather than corporate health, and he's going to have to do something about the food industry's inappropriate marketing, especially to children.
When we look at the argument that the president and the secretary have made that the United States spends so much money on health, and yet we have some of the worst outcomes in the entire world in terms of health, what do you think about the solutions? If you had the magic lever yourself, what levers would you press at HHS or elsewhere in federal government to begin to change the focus in a way that might actually make a difference for health in this country?
Well, there are two big issues in nutrition. One is undernutrition or food insecurity, people not having enough money to buy the foods and picking foods that are cheapest because that's all they can afford. So I would start with universal basic income. Why not think big? Universal basic income so that people could afford to buy food and buy what they need and buy healthier foods and wouldn't be stuck with buying the cheapest foods of the highest calories. So that's one. The second would be, because the big other public health problem is obesity and its consequences, 75% of American adults are overweight or obese, and 30 to 40% of American children are overweight or obese, and that needs to be prevented. For that, we need an agricultural system that's focused on public health, and that instead of growing food to be used as feed for animals, or even worse, fuel for automobiles, we have an agricultural system that's producing food for people. That would increase the supply of healthier foods, fruits, vegetables, grains, beans. It would decrease their cost and make those foods more available to the people who need them. Right now, only rich people can afford to eat healthfully, and there's something wrong with that picture. That's for starters.
You know, Margaret, we read the New York Times profile on you. Congratulations. It said you met your moment. Your 2002 book, Food Politics, is seen as influential because it blamed America's obesity epidemic on the food industry. Can you tell our listeners more about why you say it's to blame?
I would put that in a slightly different way. If you go online and ask what influences people's food choices, you will get answers that include what their families eat, what they like, what's available in grocery stores, what their particular cultural and religious preferences are. Nobody ever talks about food industry marketing. And what I did in my book, Food Politics, in 2002 was what I thought was being very descriptive. I was describing a food marketing environment in which the food industry, which is not a social service agency and not a public health agency, but which is a business for business reasons, was selling the most highly profitable foods in the most places, in the most to the most people in the largest possible portions. If we want to change that system, we need to do something about calories. If we're going to do something about obesity, obesity is about calories in being higher than the calories that are expended. If we're going to do something about that, we have to create a food environment that encourages people to eat reasonable amounts of food. There's enormous amounts of evidence that between 1980 and 2000, the number of calories in the food supply increased by 700 or 800, and people's consumption of those calories increased by 300 or 400 or 500 a day, more than enough to account for rising levels of obesity. So how do we get people to eat fewer calories? That's a tough one. One thing you do is you start with an educational campaign. You encourage or require food producers to produce foods in smaller amounts. I mean, if I had one explanation for the obesity epidemic, it would be that portion sizes got larger. And if I had one thing to teach the American public about portion size, it's that larger portions have more calories. I wish it were intuitively obvious. So in a sense, I blame the food industry for trying to sell more food, but they're just doing what their stockholders require. For example, I've heard food industry executives say, "We wish we could stop marketing junk food to children, but our stockholders won't let us." And that's the problem. So if I had a magic wand to wave, I would change our food investment system from one that prioritizes profits above all other considerations to one in which social values are highly valued as well. And there are B corporations that say they do that, but even they have to make an enormous amount of profit. It's very difficult for them to do that. And no large food corporations have become B corporations, except for Danone, which doesn't behave very well.
Well, Marion, in the long arc of your career, and congratulations for powering right on. We're holding you up as a model of what we all want to be doing. You've seen certainly tremendous change in the social fabric and the social network, and a couple of major ones influence food, nutrition, calories, and have an educational component. And many of these have been around starting in the early days of our engagement in community health, certainly the WIC program, certainly food stamps, certainly school lunches being widely available, and, you know, to some degree, a natural foods movement. Have any of those, do you think, been successful in getting at this fundamental issue, which does seem so simplistic, about calories in and calories out, but wanting it to be healthy calories in and good consumption of energy through exercise and so forth? What have you seen that gives you hope?
Well, I visited a lot of schools where the staff in the school believes that feeding children healthfully is the most important thing in the world that you can do. And in those schools, the food is edible and the kids are eating it. Certainly, the regulations around school meals have greatly improved the nutritional quality. The big problem with school meals is the schools don't get nearly enough money to buy the foods that many of the schools would like to be able to cook for the kids. And more money would help enormously. The Obama administration was able to change the regulations, and the research shows that for many children in America, the foods they eat in school are the healthiest they eat, which is, and some schools do this really well, some schools don't do this really well. A lot of it depends on who's in the school. What I've learned is that school food is person-dependent. It's not regulation-dependent, it's person-dependent. So that would be one thing. Certainly, the food assistance programs could be improved. That there's no question about, but the current administration wants to cut them. I don't think that cutting is going to help. It's not going to make that situation better. I'd like to see marketing restrictions on what we're now calling ultra-processed foods that require some kind of federal intervention. If we want companies to stop marketing junk foods to kids, we've got to have regulations about that. And those regulations would have to apply to social media as well, because there's all this evidence coming out that kids who use social media are exposed to dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of commercials for or advertisements for unhealthy foods during the day. I mean, there are lots of different ways in which we could intervene. The question is whether this administration is planning to do that or not. And it's very difficult to tell, because all that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has announced is he has said he really wants the color additives out of the food supply. Great. I'm for that. Yeah. He wants the generally recognized as safe loophole closed, so that food companies are no longer responsible for deciding whether the additives that they're using are safe and effective. He wants some regulation of that. I'm in favor of both of those things.
Let's take a look at both the regulations, this administration, and things that you'd want, and see if it aligns with what at least one of the items that Secretary Kennedy wants to ban, which is SNAP recipients from spending their support money on soft drinks and junk food. But the American Beverage Association says soda is not what's driving obesity. Soda calories, beverage calories overall, have been coming down while obesity rates have been rising. What's your response to that?
Well, they're not looking at who's consuming the sodas. They're very highly correlated. You know, when the food stamp program started in 1964, originally it was supposed to have sodas as sugar sweetened beverages as the category of foods that they could not use their food stamp benefits on. But there was an enormous amount of lobbying, not only from the Beverage Association, but also from retailers who make a lot of money off of SNAP recipients, to keep the sodas in there. I've been in favor of pilot projects to try to see what would happen if sodas were put into that category, where people couldn't use their electronic benefits on those sodas, but they could spend their own money on sodas if they wanted to. I've been in favor of pilot projects. Let's see what happens. Let's see how people feel about them. Because the arguments against doing that are where people don't have very many choices and this gives them choice. And it seems to me that's a reasonable argument, except that when I wrote my books, Soda Politics, I got letters from SNAP recipients saying that they would welcome restrictions on sodas because it would keep them from buying so many. Mm-hmm. And sodas are an easy target because they're sugars and water and nothing else. They have no nutritional value. And there is an enormous amount of evidence that correlates drinking of large amounts of sugar-sweetened beverages with obesity and the chronic diseases for which obesity is a risk factor. Nobody's worried about a little 8-ounce can of soda. No nutritionist would be concerned. It's the 2-liter bottles. You know, it's the quarts, it's the liters that everybody is worried about, because that's an enormous amount of sugar being dumped into metabolism, and metabolism can't handle it.
Well, it's easy to imagine, Marion, that the lobbyists descend, as they do around any issue. It's their right when policies are being proposed. It's another when policy is manipulated by the scientific establishment, or by so-called science anyway, influencing these policy decisions. And you've written some wonderful summaries of instances where organizations funded science that lands as policy directives. Maybe share one of those with our audience, just to pull that thread. It's not just lobbyists, it's using data.
I should say I wrote a book about that. It's called Unsavory Truth, How the Food Industry Skews the Science of What We Eat. There's a tremendous amount of research that demonstrates that industry funding of science influences the outcome of that of that research. And when I was working on my book, Soda Politics, I was particularly interested in soda industry funding. But while I was working on that, I was also collecting examples of industry funded research. And I think I collected 168 examples of industry funded research over a year, and 158 of those, I'm not sure of the exact numbers anymore, but I think 158 of them or something like that, had results that favored the sponsor's outcome. Food companies are not going to sponsor research unless it has a very high likelihood of giving them the kind of answers that the industry is looking for. And the food industry is looking for evidence that specific foods make people healthier, make kids smarter, and that they certainly don't cause any harm. And by this time, there's hardly a food or food product that I can think of that doesn't have a trade association behind it that's funding research. And that research, what the evidence shows is that the place where the influence most shows up is in the way the research question is framed, or in the way the results are interpreted. And I get letters from food trade associations all the time saying, we're looking for studies, for proposals for studies that will demonstrate the benefits of our product for heart disease, for cancer prevention, for cognition in children, for, you know, anything that you can think of. They're not going to fund studies that don't have a good chance of showing that. So I think that industry funded research should be published in its own journal.
Well, there has been some progress, I think, in some of the states. I think California, right, first state to ban four different kinds of food additives. West Virginia, first state to ban artificial dyes. That was interesting. And we haven't seen anybody do anything around the supersizing.
That's why the calories come in. And once you start doing that, then you're hitting the food industry where it hurts. The color additives, they're already got rid of the color additives in Europe and Australia and New Zealand and places like that. They can get rid of the color additives. And RFK Jr. has made it very clear that he expects them to, and he expects them to get rid of the color additives right away. I think they will, because remember, the purpose of a business is to make more money, not less. It's to sell more food, not less. Anything that's likely to reduce food company sales or profits is something that they feel obliged. They have a fiduciary responsibility to oppose under the current system. And food companies are under tremendous pressure these days from concerns about ultra-processed foods, what's happening with people who are taking GLP-1 drugs for obesity, who turn out not to want to be eating junk food. Junk foods are the most profitable foods in the supermarket.
I think I'm looking over your right shoulder. Is it possible I'm seeing a cereal box? Maybe tell us a little more about your thoughts about the marketing strategy, because to make more profits, you really need to have a very engaged and robust marketing campaign. So why do you collect cereal boxes?
Well, because my next book is about cereal marketing, and I'm working on it, and I'll just grab this. I bought this one from Kellogg. This is not a real cereal box. It's a joke. It's not real. But I thought I had to have it.
That's wonderful.
Quite love it. The cereal companies change the box design several times a year. The big companies do. And so they are able to respond to the latest trends in or fads in food, and can respond very, very quickly. And I've been collecting cereal boxes for about 20 years now and have quite a collection. It turns out the NYU Library has quite a collection, and we're doing a very tight, I have a co-author, and she and I are doing a very tight deconstruction of cereal boxes, and it's really about how they market. Every single element of that book, of that box, is designed for marketing, or it's something that has to be there.
So interesting. Yeah. You know, we've talked a lot about the food and eating, but we haven't said anything about the cooking end of it or the growing end of it, and would really welcome your thoughts on a community level, because all problems do not get solved in Washington. Thoughts on the community gardening.
Food is medicine.
Food is medicine. Dare I say, it would date me so much, but home ec, you know, teaching somebody how to actually cook as part of your school curriculum, which I think has evolved into a different name and more available to all people, not just girls. But what are your thoughts about some of these other pathways in that kind of subvert the supermarket aisle?
Well, I'm very interested in nutrition for kids, and because that's really what I worry about. And I've been to loads of schools that have school gardens. And let me tell you, they're transformative. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely astounding to watch teenage boys in Harlem, where I went to one, go out and pick lettuce and vegetables and put together a salad and make the dressing and serve it and eat it and ask for more because it's so delicious to them. It's totally transformative in kids' relationships to food. Many kids are completely unfamiliar with fruits and vegetables. They haven't seen them grown. They've never been on a farm. And there's something about growing your own food that's absolutely thrilling. It's so much fun. And the schools that are doing that are performing an enormous public service. When Alice Waters first started talking about school gardens, everybody thought she was crazy.
Right.
But now there are thousands of schools, literally, that have these things, and they're astonishing to watch. And schools in which there's an opportunity to teach about food, where the food is being cooked from scratch, are very, very different experiences than in schools that are using packaged foods because they don't have kitchens or because they just absolutely do not have enough money to buy what they need. So I think school food is hugely important. I'm greatly in favor of everybody learning how to grow foods and everybody learning how to cook. Cooking is really fun. You get to eat it afterward.
Well, you know, you also authored the book, Why Calories Count, and you're skeptical of our ability to count calories.
Oh, it's impossible. You can't tell by looking at a food how many calories it has. And the only way that you can tell if you're eating the right amount is by weighing yourself regularly on a scale. If your weight is going up, you're eating too much. Period. End of story. Very, very few people can do enough. Only elite athletes or people who are exercising for many, many, many hours a day will be burning off enough calories to make a difference. Because, I mean, the rule of thumb I use is it takes about 100 calories to walk or run off a mile. So if you have a 200 or 300 calorie soft drink, you've got to walk or run 3 miles to work it off. A lot of people don't do that or can't do that. You know, I remember when I was young and when my kids were young, we didn't eat between meals. Here's a rule. The more times a day you eat, the more calories you take in. The larger the portions, the more calories you take in. We weren't allowed to eat between meals. And if we got hungry, we got hungry. You can wait for an hour. Many, the social norms have changed. So the idea that somebody will go for more than 2 hours without eating seems kind of ridiculous to people right now, but it didn't used to be that way. And kids were thinner. You look at school pictures from 30 or 40 years ago, you look at school pictures now, there's a really, really big difference. So people are eating too much. And how do you get people to eat less? Really hard. That's why these GLP-1 drugs are so effective. They're getting people to eat less. So you have to change the food environment to a food environment that promotes eating more healthfully. People rarely pig out on salads. So one idea would be don't eat ultra-processed foods or eat ultra-processed foods in very, very small amounts and, you know, use them as occasional treats. That shouldn't be what everybody's eating all the time. You know, and portion sizes have expanded enormously. Bagels and muffins used to be what are now called mini bagels and mini muffins. And
pizzas
have doubled or tripled in size.
Dr. Marian Nessel, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. We've looked forward to this interview. We thank you for your research, your education, your advocacy, and all that you've contributed to this country.
This interview was with health expert Dr. Marion Nissel and was moderated by co-hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner on Conversations on Healthcare. They're conversations with creative thinkers and doers from all parts of the world who enlighten and inspire those who believe that healthcare is a right, not a privilege. Still to come on Main Street, Our Living Lands, This Week in Water, Harvest Public Media, and Dr. Tom Ezern with another of his Plains Folk essays. Stay with us.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez, and this is Our Living Lands. In the Arctic, temperatures are rising four times faster than the rest of the world. For Indigenous people in the Arctic, these shifts can be life-changing. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Priscilla Frankson, an Inupiaq researcher, about climate change's impact in the Arctic.
Can you share what life is like in the Arctic from your perspective, especially during winter?
So all of the ice is where the walrus, the bearded seals, all of the smaller seals, that's where they live and that's what they follow. And so for us, we follow the ice because the ice has food on it. And so by the time it hits June, which is when I go home a lot, the ice is still there. It's usually getting ready to break off. And so it'll still be close to shore. And we just go over to the big patches of ice. And so obviously winter is really important for that freeze up to have and make sure that the ice is ready when the animals are there or when they start coming in.
And how is climate change affecting the land and animals and the traditional ways of life in your territory? And what are some of the changes that you've seen?
So most of the work that I do is very much based around subsistence hunting and the protection through policies, through laws, and the more inability of laws and policies to protect our way of life specifically. A lot of the main areas that they cover are in Northwest Alaska. So a lot of the food that we eat is our two main keystone species are bowhead whale and caribou. And unfortunately, because of rising temperatures, because of differences in the way that climate is changing, and a lot of many, many, many other factors, the caribou are migrating at different times. So they're not going through our area like they used to, or they're not going through areas that they would historically go through.
And speaking of caribou, that leads up to my next question. Could you share a little bit about your research and the work that you do, relating to the caribou and how traditional knowledge and indigenous foodways come together in your research and community efforts?
Yeah. With caribou specifically and a lot of other animals that we catch, they're pre-colonization. They were our own governing systems that would allow us to make sure that we never overhunted, that we never overharvested, we never took more than we needed. And so we had our own system prior to these written laws and policies. And so because they weren't written, they were not seen as important as more institutional written laws. And so then you have these systems where we have our own laws and rules that we follow, but we're then forced to follow rules that are implemented from outside entities.
In what ways are your people adapting to climate change and the other, many challenges that they might face? And how does tradition guide your response to these changes?
The Arctic is warming at, four times the rate as other places. There are a lot of changes happening, but at the end of the day, it is just something that we also have to adapt to. We're having to change the times when we hunt caribou, or because they're at such a low number, we just have to stop hunting these ones specifically as much. But I think it would be really, really wonderful to have that seat at the table, to have a big voice in policy and to make sure that our voices within the community are heard at larger levels.
And can you share with our listeners a little bit about what home sounds like?
So some of my favorite sounds that I hear are the aluminum boat, and then you hear little pieces of ice just hitting against the boat. And you hear the water. It's a cloudy day and it's still very beautiful and it's really cold. I think it was June when I recorded this video and I was in full winter gear. Like I had my big boots on, I had my snow pants, I had my hat and like three jackets. So that kind of like gives you an idea of how cold it is still. And plus you're on the water where there's ice. And so that's even like colder too. It's such a special feeling being home.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, specializing in helping new and established investors hit their goals from single family to commercial investing. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
Here's some recent positive stories from H2O Radio you might have missed.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
And I'm Franny Halperin. Over 100 countries agreed to cut climate pollution from the shipping industry.
That's a remarkable development given most goods involved in the current trade war move around the world on ocean-going vessels, which happen to belch a significant amount of greenhouse gas emissions.
Starting in 2028, ships will be required to increase their use of less carbon-intensive fuels or face a penalty if they exceed a fixed emissions threshold.
The draft accord was signed at a meeting of the International Maritime Organization and is expected to generate revenue that will be used to fund innovation in the shipping sector with a goal of cutting emissions 20% by 2030.
Most experts say that goal is not achievable. That's a sentiment shared by Pacific Island nations, which are most affected by rising sea levels and who abstained from the vote, saying the agreement was too weak.
Oil-producing countries like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Russia, and Venezuela also opposed the decision. The United States pulled out of the talks, threatening to impose reciprocal measures against any fees charged to American ships.
Environmentalists criticized the deal, saying it will encourage destructive biofuels that can lead to deforestation rather than more sustainable green hydrogen fuels. However, despite lacking unanimous support, the agreement marks the first time a global industry will pay a price on its climate pollution. Antibiotics have been used to treat bacterial infections since the early 20th century, but their overuse has led to superbugs that are resistant to many medications, so there's an urgent need to find new drugs.
Turns out that oysters may offer pearls of wisdom. According to new research by Southern Cross University, proteins in their blood can kill certain bacteria responsible for a range of infections.
Oysters, which are filter feeders, have evolved strong defense mechanisms against bacteria in their marine environments, and one such weapon is a protein in their blood that can prevent and disrupt biofilms, sticky substances created by bacteria to evade a host's immune system and many antibiotics they may be taking.
The researchers found that the protein can also significantly improve the effectiveness of antibiotics to which bacteria have become resistant.
While a new antibiotic derived from oyster blood is still some time off, the discovery brings hope for natural alternatives to treat infections.
Until then, the researchers say don't slurp oysters in place of antibiotics, but go ahead and enjoy them. They contain zinc, fatty acids, and vitamins that can keep you healthy.
Most of us have a healthy respect for lightning and will seek shelter during thunderstorms. But the almendro tree, native to Central and South America, seems to dare nature to bring it on.
According to striking new research by the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies, the trees appear to thrive by getting zapped with millions of volts of electricity.
The shocking discovery was made by lead author Evan Gora, who, during field work in Panama, noticed that the almendro had survived a lightning strike with little damage, while more than a dozen neighboring trees died.
He saw that the strike had not only left the tree mostly unscathed, It also killed parasitic vines or lianas clinging to its branches.
His ensuing research of over 90 trees in Panama concluded that almendro seek out lightning to weed out competition for light and nutrients, both from other trees and the infesting vines.
The team says almendro's wide branching habit and height make them natural lightning rods that are up to 70% more likely to get electrocuted than other trees, which in the end boosts the species' ability to produce offspring.
And finally, to the Czech Republic, where officials have spent 7 years trying to develop a solution to protect the Klabava River from sediment and acidic water spilling from nearby ponds contaminated by previous military activity.
Officials determined that a dam would solve the problem and, as a bonus, create nature-rich wetlands. So they secured $1.2 million to fund the project. However, it became stalled over permitting and land ownership disagreements.
Meanwhile, as Radio Prague International reported, seemingly overnight and without permits, plans, or patience for red tape, the dams got built. Not by humans, but by a colony of 8 beavers who constructed several barriers exactly where humans wanted them and for free.
Scientists often call beavers ecosystem engineers, and Jaroslav Obermeier of the Czech Nature and Landscape Protection Agency agreed, saying the rodents had intuitively selected the best location for their dams, better than what engineers had planned.
The Eurasian beavers, which were once hunted nearly to extinction, are being celebrated by environmentalists who say the wetlands and pools they created will be excellent habitat for the rare stone crayfish, as well as numerous insects, fish, amphibians, birds, and other wildlife. Leave it to beavers. That's it for our Best Of edition. We'll see you next week.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. With egg prices soaring, more families are turning to backyard chicken rentals as a fun and educational way to secure a fresh egg supply. Rental services like Four Feathered Hens deliver hens and coops directly to homes, offering first-timers a low-commitment way to try out chicken ownership, as we hear in this report from Harvest Public Media.
Four chickens snack on a treat of dried mealworms, which Katie Hitt shakes into the run of their coop from a red plastic cup. These chickens have lived in Hitt's backyard in St. Louis for just over a week. She and her family have enjoyed the pale blue eggs the hens lay, and her three young kids are having fun with the birds.
That's the first thing they're thinking of when they wake up in the morning is like, how are the chickens and what are they doing?
This is Hitt's first time having chickens. She says she's wanted them for a while, but she was nervous about doing something wrong. She doesn't know anyone with a backyard flock, and there's an overwhelming amount of advice online.
Looking at all these things, and I just wasn't sure what the right move would be.
But then Hitt heard about chicken rentals. She could have her birds and coop delivered right to her home, expert advice, and only a 1-year commitment renting. So the chickens moved in.
It was just like, boom, there we go. We didn't have chickens one day, and then we had a whole setup the next.
People are flocking towards backyard chickens this year. Rent the Chicken, a national backyard rental business, opened over a decade ago. Co-founder Jen Tompkins says rental interest is high.
We've been so busy, we haven't even been able to compare numbers now versus last year. But when we looked in February, we were already about 20% ahead on this year versus last year this time.
Hatcheries across the Midwest say they're also flooded with orders. Some point to the recent expensive egg prices and shortages as the reason why.
Things exploded, and it's almost 100% to do with eggs, the cost of eggs specifically.
That's Tom Watkins, the president of Murray McMurray Hatchery in Webster City, Iowa, which sells about 3 million chicks a year to people across the U.S. Typically, the hatchery sells out about 2 to 3 weeks in advance, but this year, Watkins says they're sold out through October.
So that's 40 weeks of chickens that are pre-sold. We have literally sold them, you know, counted them before they hatched. So
to be clear, even when eggs were at a record high average of $6.23 in March, you'd still be shelling out more to keep chickens than just buying the eggs. Katie Bell is an agriculture educator with the University of Illinois Extension. She says all the needed supplies, like the coop, the feed, and the fencing to protect the birds from predators, cost at least a few hundred dollars.
You could easily spend $500, you know, before you even get the birds.
And that goes for renting chickens, too. In St. Louis, Emily and Tom Schnitzer opened their chicken rental business for feathered hens at the beginning of this year. They offer 6 or 12-month rentals. Their packages start at $95 per month for a year-long commitment and go up from there. Emily says their most expensive package at $190 a month includes full care of the birds.
We'll come out, we'll feed the chickens, we'll change out the bedding in the coop, make sure everything is like going smoothly, just so it's pretty much the family only has to collect the eggs.
Katie Hitt is renting from the Schnitzers. Her family is caring for the chickens themselves. Hitt says her kids are picky eaters, but they want to eat the eggs from their chickens.
This is like, oh, I know my chicken. You know, they're already deciding whose chicken is who. My chicken laid this one. I'm going to eat that one. And so it's really cute.
Hitt's not sure yet if she'll keep the chickens after the year is up. But for now, she's enjoying the experience. I'm Skylar Rossi, Harvest Public Media.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest. It reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues.
Dakota Pro Musica is presenting a special concert titled We Believe to honor the 1700th anniversary of the Nicene Creed. The concert will feature 5 settings of the Creed, a full Renaissance Mass setting, motets, and Gregorian chant. The concerts will be May 3rd at the Cathedral of the Holy Spirit in Bismarck and May 4th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Hague, North Dakota. More information online at dakotapromusica.org or on their Facebook page.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this episode of Plains Folk, Tom Ezern explores the year 1889, when 5 Great Plains states were born, and the enduring ideals their constitutions once reflected. Drawing from Samuel Western's new book, The Spirit of 1889, Ezern reflects on what we've lost in our political culture and whether we can reclaim it.
The year 1889 is so full of meaning in the history of the Great Plains. To Samuel Western, that's his real name, seriously, it connotes the writing of constitutions, 5 of them, all in the Great Northwest, North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho, as authorized by Congress in the Omnibus Bill of 1889. He writes about them in his new book from University Press of Kansas, The Spirit of 1889, Restoring the Lost Promise of the High Plains and Northern Rockies. It's not a perfect book. Occasionally, I hear an axe grinding in the background, and now and then, as a historian, I want to contest some point of authority, but still, Western brings a powerful, if critical, message to the prairies. I have ordered multiple copies so I can gift one to each member of my district legislative delegation. Presumptuous, you think? Well, who among us has not mourned the decline in civility and the partisan stubbornness of our regional politics in this century? Who has not suspected that our political intrigues are products of outside agitators, think tanks, dark money, and all that? Minority party members rail against majority dominance, but I have had personal conversations with majority party representatives who say they long for the better days in the past, when they talked across the aisle and agreed or disagreed as friends. It's not a matter of blame, Western says, although it may be a matter of regret. It's a matter of history, economic and cultural. He sees the 5-state area as a sort of constitutional region with a common history of origin. Leaders herein, he says, possessed a unique set of values. It's time to bring them back into circulation. The Spirit of 1889 had these characteristics. hostility to American Indians, and most any people of color. Okay, our bad. Respect for the promise of women in society and advanced attitudes toward their rights. Commonwealth values, that is, genuine concern for the public good. Enthusiasm for capitalism, but not necessarily for free markets or laissez-faire ideology. We liked making money from the start. Confidence in the ability of the state to be a force for good. Western essentially asks, what the heck happened to us? He thinks we have descended into a civic and political nightmare where there are no common values. This may be an overstatement, but there is truth and concern in it. How did it happen? He says our values have been hijacked. It happened not by default, but because at key junctures of our history, instead of broadening our economic and social base, we entrenched with major commodities, agricultural and mineral, and rested content in a colonially dependent status. In terms of agency and imagination, we hollowed out. This, in turn, made us vulnerable to takeover, the more so as media consolidation and communications technology drowned the independent voices among us. This is not just a matter of public policy. The attitudes percolate into folk culture. So I'm reading and listening for the spirit of 1889.
That's our dear friend, Dr. Tom Ezern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Dr. Ezern brings us his Plainspoke Essays Weekly here on Prairie Public, and we're grateful.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 29th. On this date in 1892, Wahpeton papers reported that Gertrude Weber had traveled to St. Joseph, Missouri, in search of her husband. With help from local police, she found him working at a shoe factory. To avoid arrest, Mr. Weber pretended to be overjoyed to see his wife and agreed to return with her to Wahpeton. He asked for a few hours to settle his affairs and gather his belongings. He took Mrs. Weber to a hotel, but then escaped by train with the notorious Madam Dolly Anderson. Mrs. Weber soon realized she had been doubly duped. Earlier, Mr. Weber, using a false name, had written to a Wahpeton lawyer inquiring about his wife. The lawyer showed the letter to Mrs. Weber, who recognized her husband's handwriting. Upon learning his location, she resolved to track him down. Back in Wahpeton, she discovered that Mr. Weber had also been corresponding with Judge Folsom Dow, requesting a divorce. Dow responded with a letter containing harsh and derogatory comments about Mrs. Weber. Mr. Weber took that letter to a Missouri newspaper, hoping to have its defamatory content published. Instead, the newspaper turned on Judge Dow. The editor advised Dow that, if he was a lawyer, to go to night school and learn to spell and to study the subject of sending filthy matter through the U.S. mail. The paper also reprinted what Wahpeton papers had said in support of Mrs. Weber, noting the public sympathy for her efforts to earn a living and support her family. She had been left to run a hotel on the rougher end of town after her husband fled, and had been harshly judged by Dow for liquor law and bawdy house violations on the property. Mrs. Weber later confronted Judge Dow with a horsewhip on Wahpeton's main street. The Wahpeton Times described the fracas as quite an extended one, reporting that Mrs. Weber used her whip very dexterously, striking a dozen or so more times. The streets quickly filled with spectators, and the scene became a major source of amusement for the crowd. The paper added that the universal verdict was clear. Judge Dow was wrong to write to Mr. Weber as he had, and no one seemed to blame Mrs. Weber for fighting back. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
That's it for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, it's another of our popular philosophical currents. We'll sit down with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein and contemplate the resurrection of animals distinct from the earth for 72,000 years. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.